Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, our monthly book show's theme is escape. With us is reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning.
And Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop. Hi, Ray.
Good morning.
All right. So a couple of weeks ago on our monthly show on mental health, we talked about the importance of escape. On your mental health, we talked about escaping through a film. But of course, we can also escape in books. And we've got, and this is a, I guess, Jill, how did you define escape?
Well, I asked somebody. There seemed to be so many possibilities. And I had not thought of escape as a good radio show, but it turns out it's very, has a lot of depth. And there's a lot of different ways to look about escapes and what's good about escapes, what's maybe bad about jail escapes, what kids might enjoy escaping their house for a certain part of time. So it has a lot of different meanings. And I asked one of my friends what he thought that escape would be, and he wrote something which I think is great, and none of which I had thought of. He wrote, "What qualifies as escape? Your very question." And he wrote, "Walden, quote, at present I'm a sojourner in civilized life again. Post-escape, where the wild things are, Melville's Moby Dick, which does begin as an escape story with Ishmael feeling blue and needing to get away, Melville's first novel, Teepee, which features an escape within an escape within an escape, with the protagonist Tomo jumping ship and joining the natives and then having to run again from the natives who he thinks want to eat him. Lots of escapes in the Odyssey, especially the one from Polyphemus's cave, Shelley's Frankenstein, or her last novel, many slave narratives, Frederick Douglass and Crafts, the Bondswoman narrative, Colson Whitehead, the Underground Railroad, Uncle Tom's Cabin, the Count of Monte Cristo.
Why don't we have him on the show?
I know, he finishes saying, I could go on, but maybe you can tell me what kinds of escapes you're looking for, which was a hard thing to decide what escapes, because it does have so many different possibilities to it.
And Ray, were you looking at that same kind of question, or did you go escape thinking vacation?
Similar to you, Jill, there are many ways to interpret escape. And I mean, books themselves are an escape.
Yeah.
And escapism has become very popular, especially since the pandemic. And it's been really interesting because a lot of the trends in reading have been towards like darker themes, which is interesting because during the pandemic, we were all experiencing dark times. So you'd think, you'd want something light. No, people just wanted different problems.
Different problems. Interesting. So do you actually have people who come into the store and say, I'm looking to escape, and can you recommend something?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Huh? Yeah. I mean, I think that's the point of most reading is to escape your own reality and go into a whole nother world.
I suppose when you're talking about the dark stories, it's like, wow, my life isn't as bad as this one, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, what about fantasy? Do they come in? Does that fall under escapism?
I would say, yeah.
Fantasy is huge right now. Yeah. Yes.
All right. Before we get into the first book, if listeners, if you have a book you want to put on our list today for a great escape, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Jill, what's your first book?
Okay. Well, my first book, it's sort of somewhat happy, somewhat sad. And I'd never heard of it before. And thanks to the Oak Bluffs Public Library for having a copy of this, because I was just sort of looking through the online catalog, saying, where am I going to find something about escape? Well, this is a picture book. It is not, however, for small children. They say like fifth grade and up kind of picture book, or for adults for that matter. It is called Escape, One Day We Had to Run, written by Ming and Hua. And it is basically about various people who have had to escape their countries for various reasons. But again, a picture book. And the title on the front of the title page is Escape, and it's Escape, verb, to avoid a threatening evil, which is what this book is about. And it has a whole group of words that are how people left where they were leaving, where they were going from. So there are words like cling and dart and defy and disguise, flee, fly, pedal, raft, sprint, stowaway, swim, tunnel. All those were ways that people left their countries for one reason or another. And there are maps of where people left. But one of the things that really surprised me about this, because having read lots of books from this couple, I was surprised. What they did was, pedal is their word, pedal, set off, cycle, pedal for your life. And they write, husband and wife team Hans and Margaret Ray were in Paris working on a story about a little monkey when they were forced to gather their artwork and manuscripts and flee on two homemade bikes hours before the Nazis invaded Paris with German planes flying overhead. They cycled for 4 days through the rainy countryside towards the south of France, finally reaching the Spanish border. There they sold their bikes and bought train tickets to Lisbon. From Portugal, they sailed to Brazil, then continued by boat to New York. The Rays fled war-ravaged Europe carrying the manuscript for the first Curious George picture book.
Interesting.
It was published a year later and has since sold over 25 million copies worldwide. Mm. So it's you learn things you do not know about people who have had to escape. But it's an interest, and the illustrations are also quite lovely. But it's not. It's dark, but they do escape. I mean, I suppose the upside of this is they do actually all escape, but they escape out of terrible situations.
Yeah. All right.
So it is indeed called Escape. One Day We Had to Run.
All right. Ray.
So my first one is The Spell Shop. We're by Sarah Beth Durst. We mentioned fantasy earlier. So this falls into the cottagecore subgenre of the subgenre of fantasy, which is cozy fantasy.
This is cozy fantasy?
Cozy fantasy.
Okay, I'm in. I love that.
I've heard of cozy mysteries.
Yes, there is also cozy fantasy.
Great.
Yeah, and this is cottagecore. So cottagecore is basically, you know, picture a little cottage in the woods, simple rural life, connection to nature. So this is about a woman named Keela who works at the Great Library of Elysium. And it's a library basically of spell books. And there's a revolution going on in Elysium, so she has to escape. And she flees to the island where she grew up, which is very peaceful, no wars going on. And so she moves into her old family home, which has been abandoned, and she has to fix up the cottage, and she starts a garden, she makes jam, she eventually starts an illegal spell shop, because magic is technically illegal, but she knows how to do it, and so she helps the people of her community with spells. And it's very light. It's very nice. I know I was talking about darker things earlier, but
it sounds like a children's movie.
It's just, yeah, it kind of is, but for adults. So if you're looking for something just very cozy, again, she has her sidekick, Kaz, which is a spider plant that can talk and kind of walk on his leaves.
What
adorable.
Spider can't talk.
I'm telling you that could be a children's movie. What's it called again?
It's called The Spell Shop by Sarah Beth Durst.
Okay. Jill.
Well, I came across a book when you said we were going to be doing this topic. I was looking through the online catalog, and one of the other things I found was this book, which was published quite some time ago, but yet was still on the shelves of Cape Cod Community College. And it is called The Escape Motif in the American Novel, Mark Twain to Richard Wright. Ooh. And the whole thing is talking about exactly what we're talking about today, is escape. And this is a little bit of his preface, which is sort of interesting. Although it is true that the motif of flight or escape appears frequently in American literature, to the best of my knowledge, the subject thus far has not been treated in a full-length study. This is what I have set out to do in the following pages. Further, I decided to limit myself to a discussion of 8 novels. I don't know how he came up with those 8 novels. I'm not. He sort of explains it. Beginning with Twain's Huckleberry Finn and ending on the threshold of mid-20th century with Richard Wright's Native Son, the first, a book that, in spite of its raw violence and its portrayal of a corrupt slave society, is filled with hope, extending to the last in which all hope has fled. I believe that both of these novels and those in between go to form a paradigmatic parabola of the escape motif. Bet you didn't know about that. Adequate enough to have made a case, I hope, for the sustained preoccupation with the theme, not only in the novels of our national literature in the late 19th century and the first several decades of the 20th, but in such critical works that have dealt with that motif in our literature. And I was surprised to see how many books he had in here that were, I was like, yeah, I guess maybe that is escape. And yeah, that does make that's escape. So, I mean, in a way, it's sort of interesting to read. It's very scholarly. Mm-hmm. But also there are books in here I've never heard of that I thought, oh, that might be a good book to read, which is one of the great things about finding a book. And then it's telling you other books you might read. But I am still surprised that Cape Cod Community College still had this on their shelf. But in fact, I couldn't find a lot. I mean, it's not as if I was finding lots of books on the escape motif, which is what he calls it. So it's an interesting book. It's Sam Bluefarb's book, The Escape Motif in the American Novel, which you can get through Clams.
All right. Thank you. Right.
So the next one is about, so it's called The True Happiness Company by Veena Dinavahi, and it's how it's her memoir of joining a cult and then leaving that cult. So I sort of thought, okay, she's escaping the cult. But really, it's fascinating because she, you know, considers herself a normal person who she's like, why would I fall for that? Why? How did that happen? And you kind of understand it because she grew up in Severna Park, Maryland, which is a place with an unusually high suicide rate. And in high school, several of her classmates committed suicide. It was a thing that she was just exposed to early on in life. And so her mental health was sort of this a high priority her whole life, and her parents were worried about her. You know, whenever she was feeling down at all, it was like kind of blown up because of this exposure to all the suicides. And so she had struggled her whole life kind of trying to maintain her mental health, be happy, don't fall into, you know, that territory. So her mom eventually finds, she's in college, and her mom finds this man named Bob Lyon on the internet, and he's in Georgia, and he calls himself the True Happiness Company, and he basically claims that he knows the key to happiness, and he's got it all figured out, and he can help her. And so they go to Georgia and they meet him, and eventually she ends up becoming, he becomes her therapist, and then she eventually drops out of college. She marries someone that she shouldn't marry. She becomes a young mother of 3, and she converts to Mormonism. And she's also calling this guy every day, multiple times a day. He's basically telling her what she calls him for everything. He tells her what to do in her life with every decision. And eventually it really goes too far. It becomes dark and weirdly sexual. And she realizes that there's just too much dissonance between her intuition and what he's telling her to do. And so she does leave him, cut her ties, starts her new life. But it's just fascinating how how she fell into it, because she is very smart, but at the time she needed the clarity and the confidence and the happiness that he claimed to know how to achieve. And so that was fascinating.
I think that's interesting, because don't you always ask, how does that happen, right? Yeah. And then if somebody who gets out of a cult goes, how did that happen, right?
Yeah.
So that's a really good question too. And the book again is called?
The True Happiness Company by Veena Dinavahi.
We are talking about books with an escape theme this morning. If you'd like to suggest something for us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show. The theme this month is escape. With us, reference librarian Jill Erickson and Ray Titcombs from Titcombs Bookshop. 866-999-4626 is our number for your suggestions. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, I came across this book on my shelf, and this one happens to be a library copy, but it is a fun book. It is a book that the library did a whole program around, including along with the fifth grade school. The book is called Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library by Chris Grabenstein. And when the book came out, I don't even know how this happened, but as it turned out, the author had some connection to Falmouth, or his wife had some connection to Falmouth. And so we, or the elementary school, suggested he come. We were working together for this because it was fifth graders who were going to come over. And part of this is about this new library that Mr. Limoncello is creating, and that all these kids are brought in to do various things during the version of the book. You're just sort of doing all kinds of things. And we decided, well, if he was going to come to talk, we should do something at our library about what he's doing in the book, and have kids come. And what we did, we had this contest with the fifth graders, and they all had to write why they should be allowed to spend the night in the library, because the idea was you got to spend the whole life. Needless to say, we didn't go all the way to the night, but we did have a bunch of kids in who were, it was the library closed and they were there till like 9 o'clock or something. So they were, and we did all these sort of tricks and things that they, and hunt, they had a hunt for various things. And when I found this blurb that I had written back in 2014 on our webpage, and it says, one of the most spectacular events that Laura and I worked on together was the night we had 12 kids in the library after hours. They had all entered a contest created around the book Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library by Chris Grabenstein, and the prize was getting to spend time in the library after it closed. What great fun it was. And then there was also an article in the Enterprise about it. Children's book comes alive one night at the library, and you can see photos actually of all of this on the library's Flickr page, which it does not, nothing's being added to that any longer because they're not using Flickr anymore. But if you go to flickr.com and look up the Falmouth Public Library and look at the albums, you can find all these kids and what they were doing. And basically, it was one of the most fun things I ever did in the library. Was it,
just in the children's library? Did you use
We started in the children's library, and then they all got to go upstairs, and we had hidden things everywhere. Oh, and there were all kinds of puzzles they had to solve.
And 12 is doable.
Well, we had, I'm trying to think how many people we had, adults that were there. There were maybe 4 adults. And we made little cards for them, and it was so fun. And the book itself is very, I think it still holds up, about what it is to go into a library and what these kids did once they were in the library and how much fun they had in the library. And it was and is Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library by Chris Grabenstein.
Libraries are magical places. We know
they
that.
They are.
Ray, what's next?
My next book is Jaws by Peter Benchley. So, it's the 50th anniversary. this year, I had to talk about Jaws. And I had not known that Jaws was a book before it was a movie until I became a full-time bookseller. And a lot of people don't realize it's a book.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. It's one of those rare instances where the movie is more famous than the book. And it was really interesting. I highly recommend reading the book and then rewatching the movie, because you'll notice all the differences, and the book is really quite different from the movie. I mean, some of the main themes are there, but it really gets into a lot more detail.
Detail about the people that are interacting?
Yeah, so it gets into the relationships more and the characters. So, for example, like in the movie, Brody, the police chief, is new in town. But in the book, he's actually from Amity Island, his wife was a summer person. So there's that tension between them, and she has all this built up resentment for, you know, she's like, oh, have I settled? Like, do I miss my, you know, rich lifestyle, and now I'm slumming it with this local guy, you know? And so relating to this theme of escape, of course, it feels like there's no escape from this shark. And in the book, it takes a lot longer to actually get the shark than it does in the movie. So the whole time you're just like, oh my gosh, he's going to keep attacking. We can't escape this. But there's also this parallel theme of escape from the people of the island are sort of held hostage to the summer tourist industry, which we can all relate to. And there's a lot of pressure from the mayor, who is being pressured by these loan sharks that he has to pay off. And so that's kind of metaphor, obviously, loan sharks, actual shark. but it's very interesting. And there's a 50th anniversary edition, which includes a foreword by Wendy Benchley, Peter's wife. And also it has things from the Benchley archives, including the manuscript's original typed title page and a brainstorming list of possible titles, which is very interesting. And a letter from Peter Benchley to the film producer of Jaws with candid feedback on the movie adaptation. So there's a lot in here, and it's very interesting, and it was fun. It was interesting to read a book from the 70s that is not like considered a classic work of literature. You know, like it's just an interesting glimpse into the time and how relationships were different and people were different. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. All right. Jaws. Chill.
I'm just mesmerized by Jaws, which I never read, but I can remember to this day seeing it in a movie theater when
everybody
it first came out.
Everybody remembers that, yeah.
Just terrifying.
That
and
first
I,
scene, yeah.
I, yeah. It's. I don't know that it holds up. Have
the
you
book
seen
is
the
less
film?
Scary. Than
oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Do you say the book is scarier?
Recently? Yeah, I've seen it many times, but I rewatched it right after I read the book, and I still jumped.
Yeah. So I have a very heavy book now in front of me, which many of you may have heard of, but not read, because sometimes people just don't get around to reading
large
books. It is a very heavy book. Yeah. It's The Decameron by Giovanni Boccaccio, in this case translated by Wayne Rebhorn. And one of the things I thought about this was that escape is a big theme at the beginning of this book. And I also can remember reading a lot of people during COVID were reading this because it was, in fact, had to do with the plague and what the plague was doing to people around them. And I found this great article in The New Yorker, which talks about this book. And I'm just going to read a little bit of it to give you an idea of what is happening. And the key is really that they're all going off and they are going to escape from the plague. And this article begins, in 1348, the Black Death, the most devastating epidemic in European history, swept across the continent. Giovanni Boccaccio, at the beginning of his famous Decameron, describes its effects on his city, Florence. Many people just dropped dead in the street. Others died in their houses, often unattended by their families. Husbands and wives, fearing infection, sat and prayed in separate rooms. Mothers walked away from their children and closed the door. In the words of a new translation of the Decameron by Wayne Rebhorn, a specialist in shop, oh, in specialists. And I've missed a piece of that sentence, but I will go, continue on because what I get to, you get the idea here of what's happening. What's happening in this novel is what was happening to all of us during COVID. But one of the pieces that's great about it, so begins that, shops stood empty, churches shut down, an estimated 60% of the population of Florence and the surrounding countryside died. And so begins the Decameron. Seven young ladies, friends, Pampania, Philomena, Niophile, Fiametta, Elisa, Loretta, and Amelia meet after Mass. They range in age from 18 to 28, and they are all of genteel birth. Let's get out of here, Pampania, the eldest says. Let's go to our country estates. The other women say they'd love to, but they think they should bring some men along. Soon they assemble three gentlemen linked to them by kinship or by affection, Philostrato, Dioneo, and Panfilo, and the 10 young people decamp at dawn for the countryside. They agree on a routine. In the morning and in the evening they will take walks, sing songs, and eat exquisite meals with fine wines, golden and red. In between, they will sit together and each will tell a story on a theme set for the day, generosity, cleverness, etc. They will stay together for 2 weeks. 2 days must be devoted to personal obligations and 2 to religious duties. That leaves 10 days. 10 tales times 10 days. At the end, they will have 100 stories. And that's what the rest of the book is really about, is them telling all these various stories. And I have to say, I first read this aloud. I'm often reading with other people aloud, but I was in high school or just out of high school, and a friend and I decided, I don't know why, that we were going to read the Decameron aloud together.
What an unusual choice for a high schooler.
I agree. I don't know what, I have no recollection as to why that was the book we picked, but it turned out to be. And so I read this very long ago. I have not gone to read it again, but this actually looks like a really good translation, and I'm sure we were using some ancient translation at that point, so which is always important, what translation is better, right. And they often do get better as they come along. Anyway, if you have a lot of time in your hands, or you just go to a bookshop and buy the book and read a little bit every week, it's The Decameron by Giovanni Boccaccio, and as I say, was a big hit during the COVID days because of similarities to what was happening.
That's what we're going through, right.
So my next one is a children's picture book. It's called The Escape Artist, a true story of octopus adventure. Ooh. So this is about the true story of Inky the octopus, who escaped from his tank at the National Aquarium in New Zealand in 2016. The tank was left ajar one night, and he crawled 10 feet across the floor into a drain, and then crawled 164 feet to the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
No one has seen him since, but it's pretty safe to assume that he made it out to the ocean. And the story is told in rhyming verse, and it's funny and it's a true story, but it's told like fiction.
Yeah. Nice illustrations.
Yeah, and it's pretty amazing what he did, and it really brings life to him.
Amazing what they can fit into, right?
Oh my gosh, yeah. They can fit into anything the size of their beak.
Wow.
Because that's the only rigid part of their body.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it has more octopus facts in the back matter.
Oh, that's a great one. It's a great...
The Escape Artist.
The Escape Artist. Okay, great. Jill.
well, the next thing I'm headed for, and this is, as soon as I heard this is what we were going to do as a subject, I immediately think of Houdini. And you will.
The great escape
the
artist.
The great escaper. And you would have no idea. I had no idea how many books have been written about Houdini, for good or bad. I mean, people who think he's the best thing in the world, and other people who think he was a fraud. And
other people want to figure out how he did it.
Everybody wants to know how to do it. I have a mere 3 books here.
Oh, wow.
But actually, one of them, well, we'll start with this one, which is The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini by Joe Posnansky. And here is a little bit about escaping. In fact, the whole chapter is called Escape. And it begins with the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 12, verse 7. And when Herod would have brought him forth the same night, Peter was sleeping between 2 soldiers, bound with 2 chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. And behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison. And he smote Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, "Arise up quickly," and his chains fell from his hands. And one of the things I found out in this book, which I had no idea, and you may have heard of this, it turns out Houdini came to Gloucester at one point in 1895, as a matter of fact. It was 1895, but, and here is a little bit what they write about his time in Massachusetts. It begins, "We don't know the first time Houdini escaped from handcuffs, but we do know that in November of 1895, he first challenged audience members to lock him in their personal handcuffs." I didn't know everybody was walking around with personal handcuffs either, but apparently they were. Although it continues to say, few people had their own set of handcuffs. It was a gimmick more than anything, but it was an effective gimmick, and the audience seemed to like it. He added it to the act. A few days later, in Gloucester, a small town on Massachusetts' North Shore, Houdini had a real moment of inspiration. He walked into the local police station and challenged the officers to lock him in handcuffs. They did it. He escaped. And the whole thing got a brief mention in the newspaper. That told Houdini he was on to something. He generally measured his success by newspaper ink. A couple of days later, he went into a police station in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, and escaped from handcuffs in 18 seconds. He received a full story this time. Then he did it in Worcester, Massachusetts. Quote, "He unlocks them all with as much ease as if they were strings around his wrists," the local paper reported. Then it was off to Holyoke, where he received eerily similar praise. Quote, "It makes no difference with Mr. Houdini what kind of handcuffs are produced," end quote, the reporter wrote. Quote, "He unlocks them all with as much ease as if they were strings around his wrists," end quote. Why do both stories sound alike? Because Houdini wrote them. He wrote all the stories that appeared in newspapers in the early days. This wasn't exactly uncommon. Other entertainers wrote their own billings, but nobody has as much enthusiasm for the activities of self-promotion as Houdini has.
That sounds about right.
So this is The Life and Afterlife of Harry Houdini, but there is also Escape, the Story of the Great Houdini, which is in fact a kid's book, and it is by Sid Fleischman, and it is a really interesting book about, and again, a little bit older, I think, for kids. And in the Horn Book Review, they wrote, "Adopting a tone somewhere between vaudeville announcer and carnival barker, Fleischman lures readers to the greatest show of all, reading." So that's a good thing. And one other book, which is a play, which was done by Muriel Ruckhauser, a musical, Houdini, which apparently bombed completely, but was first shown in Lenox, Massachusetts at the Lenox Arts Center. And it was a poet who was doing this. She was clearly very interested in Houdini. She was the one that wrote it. She was a major poet, and it was written in the New York Times as, "Miss Ruckhauser, a major poet, is found in Harry Houdini, the famous magician and escape artist, a near tragic figure who could break out of any confinement man could devise, but never sever the invisible cords that bound him to his mother." So this is an interesting collection of Houdini books. There are probably
dozens more, 100 more, sure. Yeah,
but
yeah.
These were the ones that caught my eyes.
All right, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly book show, and the theme is escape. With us is reference librarian Jill Erickson and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Book Shop and Sandwich. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what have you got next?
My next one is Save Our Souls by Matthew Pearl. And it is a true story of a castaway family. So it's like a real life Swiss Family Robinson. I always loved that movie as a kid. And but it has a dark twist because there is a murderer involved. Uh-oh. There's betrayal. It is a thrilling piece of history. So in 1887, the Walker family set out on a shark fishing expedition. Captain Frederick Walker always brought his family on his fishing expeditions, which was kind of unusual, but the family was very adventurous, and they all were pretty tough people, and they loved sailing around the world. So they and their family dog got washed, their boat sank, they got washed ashore on an island, and with a couple of their crewmates. And there is betrayal with the crewmates. There's potentially a murderer on the island. There's this man who helps them. He's very nice at first. He shows them all the resources on the island, how to get water, etc. And then they figure out he's very dark and menacing. So it's about their escape from the island, their escape from this man, and how far they would go to save their family. Really.
You can't great, make great. This up, right?
And I know. I read the description of this book and I was like, I have to read this. I can't believe this is real life. So it's called Save Our Souls by Matthew Pearl.
All right. Jill.
Okay, well, I've got a novel by Richard Stark called Breakout. And I thought, you know, there's got to be a lot of stories about people breaking out. You know, they want to escape from where they are.
Like jail?
Like jail, that's correct. You got that one right. It's a fascinating little story here, but I also, the review of it in the New York Times is pretty funny. And this came out in 2002, Marilyn Stasio writes, "It takes a cunning mind to break out of jail, but it takes a truly twisted mind to break out of one jail, only to break into another fortress from which, perforce, the break-in artist must subsequently break out and then repeat the entire exercise. We have met this devious mind, and it is a creation of Richard Stark, who applies his great wit and dexterous mental skills to a series of such ingenious exits and entrances in what else? Breakout. The mastermind of these exploits is, of course, the career criminal known as Parker, as cool a customer as ever tunneled under a library, through the foundations of an armory, and into a jewelry vault, which happens to be one of the more challenging misadventures that Parker gets up to in this jam-packed plot. Richard Stark, which, by the way, is the name that Donald E. Westlake uses when he lets Parker off the leash, writes with ruthless efficiency. His bad guys are polished pros who think hard, move fast, and turn on a dime in moments of crisis. And because talk doesn't come cheap, every bit of dialogue counts. One line from Parker's cellmate in Stoneveld Detention Center, quote, "I can feel myself getting smaller every day. You fight it, but there it is," end quote, says all that needs to be said about the man and his motives. It's an art. And a very, you know, it's very interesting. It's a compelling little story about breaking out of a prison. I am sure there are trillions of them, This is Breakout by Richard Stark.
Okay. Thank you. Right.
So my next one is The Night Flyer, Harriet Tubman and the Faith Dreams of a Free People by Tia Miles. And so Harriet Tubman is arguably, in a way, the greatest, one of the greatest escape artists of all time.
For sure, yeah.
And this book in particular goes deeper into studying her as a complete human, sort of, rather than this mythical superhero we sort of think of her as. So Tia Miles explores Tubman's life with tenderness and imaginative genius. She studies the ecological reality of Tubman's surroundings, and along with Tubman's story, she weaves in quotes from other enslaved women of the time who actually wrote memoirs. Since Tubman never wrote her own memoir, we can only imagine what she thought. But it's really creative the way that Miles uses other people of the time who were in similar situations to figure out, try to be as accurate as possible in figuring out how Harriet Tubman thought and what she was like. And she was really quite amazing. She was the first woman who led a military raid, and she freed about 700 people, beyond, of course, escaping her own enslavement and returning to lead others north time and time again to freedom without loss of life. And this book really gets into her spirituality, her mysticism, and the importance of her beliefs as a motivation for all of her amazing feats. Despite all odds, she had a brain injury. She had, I think, a broken leg at one point. What she did was just truly
amazing. She defied all odds.
Miraculous. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that they took quotes from other women of the time, because you really don't know what she was thinking, but at least that gives you some sort of indication of what would have been happening with other women of that time.
Yeah. And it's a more authentic way to do that, I think. Yeah. So that's Night Flyer by Tia Miles.
Thank you. Jill.
Okay, well, I felt I had to bring one of two books. I had to either bring Peter Pan or The Wizard of Oz.
You chose correctly.
So I went with The Wizard of Oz. And I have this copy. I've never actually read this. I've only seen it over and over again. So one of the things I was really fascinated by this was the fact that some things are not the same in the film. What a surprise. Not the same in the film. The first one was, of course, went from black and white to color, but this is a little bit, it's like, the wicked woman was greatly pleased with the success of her trick, for as long as she had one of the shoes, she owned half the power of their charm, and Dorothy could not use it against her, even had she known how to do so. The little girl, seeing she had lost one of her pretty shoes, grew angry and said to the witch, "Give me back my shoe." "I will not," retorted the witch, "for it is now my shoe and not yours." "You are a wicked creature," cried Dorothy. "You have no right to take my shoe from me." "I shall keep it just the same," said the witch, laughing at her, "and someday I shall get the other one from you." This made Dorothy so very angry that she picked up the bucket of water that, and we know what's about to happen here, she picked up the bucket of water that stood near and dashed it over the witch, wetting her from head to foot. Instantly, the wicked woman gave a loud cry of fear, and then as Dorothy looked at her in wonder, the witch began to shrink and fall away. "See what you have done," she screamed. "In a minute, I shall melt away." "I'm very sorry indeed," said Dorothy, who was truly frightened to see the witch actually melting away like brown sugar before her very eyes. "Didn't you know water would be the end of me?" asked the witch in a wailing, despairing voice. "Of course not," answered Dorothy. "How should I?" Which I think is a very funny line.
This is near the beginning of the book.
Well, this is many volumes. There were many volumes having to do with Oz. Okay. So this is just one of some. And one of the other things that is very different here is the silver shoes, said the good witch, have wonderful powers. And one of the most curious things about them is that they can carry you to any place in the world in 3 steps, and each step will be made in the wink of an eye. All you have to do is to knock the heels together 3 times and command the shoes to carry you wherever you wish to go. Everyone who's seen the movie knows they're
They're red.
They're ruby red.
So why the filmmakers decided they wanted to make, I guess they look better on film than silver.
Color.
But yeah, silver shoes seem pretty more exciting, really, in some ways than red shoes. But I just, you know, it's worth taking some time to read the actual book, because the actual book, most of is the
same.
But
always different than the movie. Always, All right. Ray.
So the next one is Sherlock Holmes Escape Book, The Adventure of the Two Flying Scotsmen by Ormond Sacker. So this is really a puzzle book, and what they call an escape book. So you have to, throughout the whole book, you have to solve puzzles and riddles and all kinds of things. And there's even on the cover here, you spin this wheel to help you decode different things solve.
Boy, would I have liked that in seventh grade.
is that for young people?
No, this is for adults.
Adults.
And it's the fifth title in the Sherlock Holmes Escape series, Escape Book series. And it's Sherlock Holmes and Watson find themselves trapped on a Flying Scotsman bound for Edinburgh after being mistakenly led to believe that Sherlock is needed in Scotland to thwart a plot against the Queen. Readers will quickly discover that the actual plot in motion is to rig a rail race between the two Flying Scotsmen happening that day. A race where the Queen's son, Bertie, has ill-advisedly lent money to a small gang of ne'er-do-wells within the household of the socialite Daisy Greville, a woman with whom Bertie is having a secret affair. So you have to basically make these two Flying Scotsmen race at the end of the book, and as you can see, it's really more less of a story than solving puzzles. But there is a story throughout. So I have not tackled this, but if you have a puzzling mind, it's definitely for you.
All right. It's called again?
The Adventure of the Two Flying Scotsmen, a Sherlock Holmes Escape Book.
All right, you got about a minute, Jill.
Okay, the picture book I brought, the other picture book is Harold and the Purple Crayon by Crockett Johnson.
Don't we all want a purple crayon?
And, you know, it's just such a great story, and it holds up incredibly well. It begins one evening after thinking it over for some time, Harold decided to go for a walk in the moonlight, which he does, and he carries it all over and creates all kinds of things as a result. It is really such a perfect book, and he is escaping in his own way. And he does, of course, come back, but sometimes you want to escape and then you take the time to come back once you have left. And there's a great article about Anita Silvey, who is worked for Hornbook magazine for many, many years, and she wrote about it. Today, Harold and the Purple Crayon has sold 2 million copies and has never gone out of print, but it failed to impress Johnson's editor, Ursula Nordstrom, when she first saw it. Quote, "It doesn't seem like a good children's book to me," and the quote, the ever frank Nordstrom quipped. But she admitted in the same letter that she might have turned down Tom Sawyer, given the mood was in that day. Looking at the book again, Nordstrom apologized for an initial unenthusiastic response and published the book in 1955.
And the movie is also very charming. If you have youngsters, you got to check out the movie as well. All right, Jill Erickson, reference librarian, Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we will have a link to the books we talk about a little later today at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.